A car is never just a car. Kelley Blue Book knows it's so much more than that. It's your commuting chariot, your road trip refuge, your I just need a reason to get out of the house. Your car is there for everything. And for everything car, there's Kelley Blue Book. Need a new set of wheels? Price it on Kelley Blue Book. Problem under the hood? Fix it with Kelley Blue Book. Can another car do the job better? Trade it or sell it on Kelley Blue Book. We're here mile after mile, moment after moment. Price it, fix it, trade it, sell it. KBB.com. Visit KelleyBlueBook.com to get the journey started.
For over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night. No matter how chaotic your day is, conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.
And we are back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel. And I just want to say to people who are watching us on YouTube, which you can do every week, this is the last bit of Kylie merch I own. I will be returning to my normal clothes next week. But anyway, I'm Louis Fertel. And it's a sad week here at Keep It because after years in the biz, Ira and I are separating from Scooter Braun. And I am sorry we have to report it this way after such a fruitful and productive partnership.
His bills have been affected. The girls are leaving. Here's my thing. I am like, what's going on?
I would love to know.
Because
it's in droves.
I could get someone leaving Scooter Braun, but my thing is Justin Bieber, Demi Lovato, Ariana Grande. Girl, once the Ronan Farrow report dropping?
It really feels like some publicist got in a little caucus, said something is up, something's about to come out, because these are the cream of his crop, right?
I know.
Maybe someone also told them that he's an adult named Scooter, and they should just get away. Girlfriend, this isn't the Muppet Show. Don't be trusting people named Scooter.
I'm sure something messy will come out, but actually something messy should come out now.
Meaning?
Listen, I had like so much fun first of all, I was rewatching the YouTube channel and like seeing your face when Punky was like, girl, what's going on in your relationship? And you were like,
I was wondering if they edited that together, me gulping 15 times. I sounded like an idiot.
I mean, it was probably like the Big Brother producers like making like Heisen look evil. It was like, let's make Lewis look goofy. But we do have a guest of guests this week. Like, she is an icon. She's a legend. She's currently the moment. And, like, sometimes when people say that, it's like they're over-exaggerating because they're gays on the internet. Uh-huh. But, like, this is a real Keep It icon.
And also, just like one of these people, like many of the guests we've had, where you can jump to any era of her career and just do an entire interview about that. We did our best to jump around. We have Idina Menzel with us today.
We do. We do. She has her new album coming out. Listen, she's one of the pop girls now.
Which, of course, she has that capability. She's sung everything else before. Of course, she can handle, you know, a disco tune or two.
BB Rexa, watch out. No, like, I'm like such a big fan of Idina Menzel, so we're very excited to have her on the show. And also, this week, we asked all of you to ask us pop culture questions, like an AMA,
yep.
Because one, we're lazy.
I have to say, when you provide the content, the show is easier.
We were like, should we play a game again this week? No, you know what? Ask us anything. And you know what? People love asking us anything. And I felt like this was very attuned to you because I feel you do like an AMA on Instagram every week.
I do it about once a month. And I have the delusion that people want to ask me questions and it takes no.
But they do.
Yeah. Well, right. But like it's probably the percentage of people who actually reach out compared to who doesn't. You know, like I'm not really taking that into consideration. I'm not really doing the metrics on this. But yeah, it's fun. Also, it's just like you and I will sit here and bring up the same three names again and again. It's nice to have like other names thrown into the fray from strangers and friends alike.
Eric Roberts.
Oh, have you seen Star 80 recently? It's so good.
By the way, I was thinking that I was listening to someone who was one of our regulars that, like, you bring up, but it wasn't Sandy Dennis. It was Kathy Dennis.
Kathy Dennis is the person who wrote Can't Get You Out of My Head and Toxic, and she was a pop star in her own right, who did Touch Me All Night Long and Just Another Dream.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I had some friends watch A Nightmare on Elm Street 2 for the first time, uh-huh. and there is a different song that uses sort of like the same chorus, but it led me to the Kathy Dennis. And I was like, I forgot how fucking good that song is.
That album, she has an album called Move to This. Here's a little secret about me. About 10 years ago, I did a freelance assignment for VH1 where they just wanted us to pitch shows all day to them. And then they would, if they were good, they would buy them off you for like no money at all. It was like, I don't want to call it a scam, but it wasn't like
that's
a money-making.
That's why we're striking.
Yes, right, precisely. It was a money-making operation for people that weren't me. And I pitched a show about choreographers, and I called it Move to This, based on that Kathy Dennis album, because it's one of my favorite albums.
Mm. Wow, you could have your like very own platinum hit.
Yes. Oh, my God. You can't be bringing up lesser Bravo shows right here. Look up Platinum Hit with Kara DioGuardi.
Which also, Kathy Dennis wrote Can't Get You Out of My Head and Toxic.
Yes.
And I feel like maybe she should have been in the room during Padam. Because let me tell you something.
Yeah.
Being here, like, as I said, like, I'm on Fire Island. Like, I'm, like, towards the end of my tenure here. The song is still going.
I was...
And some... some kids are still getting
right
into it.
I'm wearing a necklace that says Padam Padam
right now. But I'm just sort of like, you know who is not feeling Padam Padam? Anyone who does not suck a dick.
No. I recently was in a car with my friend Nico, and I put on an older Kylie Minogue song called Like a Drug from her album X, which is one of my favorite songs of hers. And he just goes, do you think any straight person has ever heard the song? And I said, absolutely not.
That reminds me of... So like back earlier when I had first moved to New York, I had my close friend Dan... he hadn't come out yet to like his fraternity brothers. And I remember I posted Kylie, like when, In Your Arms, like dropped, like the video dropped, I posted on his Facebook page. This is how long ago this was. And I remember he deleted it off his page, 'cause it was like, I don't need people like knowing that I'm gay, etc. But thinking about it in retrospect, can you imagine a single one of his fraternity brothers seeing a Kylie Minogue song on his Facebook page and knowing who the fuck she was?
No.
And then deducing that he's gay?
No, that's just it. You have to have the first coordinate of even knowing who she is to be able to make that deduction. So, no, I think they probably saw, like, Pig Latin. I don't know what they saw on the screen. Not even her face.
So we're going to do our AMA this week, but also... Lewis, you did see Passages.
I did. Yes, 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 yes. I decided to be like a gay person in the cultural space. Yes.
So we're going to talk about that. And we also have Kyle Turner here to talk about queer film.
And he has compiled an incredible list going back to the 1910s all the way up to these days with fabulous movies like Carol and Can You Ever Forgive Me and things we're familiar with. But we'll dig into that whole annal with him.
Yeah. You know, King Kong is suspiciously missing from that book.
And
that is a queer film.
Yeah, well,
it's queer canon.
He will be at Folsom this year. Trust me on that.
So we will be right back with more Keep It. Let me tell you something about experience, Lewis.
Uh-huh.
It does not pay the bills.
True enough. Just a basic fact of life. Okay.
Okay. That's this week's topic on Work Appropriate, where ain't nothing going on but the rent.
But the rent. Ugh, I love that song. Gwen Guthrie. Join host Anne Helen Peterson as she sits down with children's TV expert Alice Wilder to talk about internships, the benefits, free versus paid, and more. Listen to this episode and other work-related conversations every Wednesday only on Work Appropriate, wherever you get your podcasts.
One thing about our listeners is that you all have recognized that Lewis and I have impeccable taste and have never been wrong, except about Barbie.
And I'm learning. Girl. I'm listening to everybody's critiques, and I will get the right opinion soon.
They are still lighting you up about Barbie.
Well, I wish they would find something else to do. Barbie always does. She went and became a doctor and an astronaut.
Adventure Barbie.
Yeah.
She's in the woods. So we decided to do a pop culture AMA, Ask Us Anything. Technically, AMA is Ask Me Anything, but it's two of us. So it's like, I guess it's an AUA?
Sure. It doesn't roll off the tongue. I don't like to say it.
Yeah, it really doesn't. But we're going to go with some of these questions. So,
can I start with one of my own?
Please go.
Okay, good. Because, of course, my questions are equally as fascinating. Name a beloved song you never want to hear again. Can I start?
Please go.
Girls Just Want to Have Fun. I simply don't want to hear it ever again. First of all, girls are not a monolith. I think she made a leap she shouldn't have with that song. And then secondly, when it comes on, I'm just like, it feels like we're at a carnival. I can't stand the clamor of it. It's too annoying. And she's not an annoying vocalist. Like, I love Time After Time. I love Change of Heart. I love Hole in My Heart All the Way to China. Like, all through
the
night.
It is well that you picked that Cyndi Lauper song, because this, I wouldn't say that's my pick,
yeah.
But if I ever hear fucking True Colors again,
particularly at an emotional moment,
it's like, okay. And people are always like, oh, doing like an emotional cover of True Colors for like Pride or something. It's like, I don't want to hear that shit.
No, unless you are literally the Crayola Pride campaign, I do not want to hear that.
Beloved song that I never want to hear again. You know, maybe it's that. Maybe it's also, oh, you know I love Hall & Oates.
Uh-huh. Yes, this is, I'm already shocked that you've brought up Hall & Oates.
Right, because like I like heard it the other day, and it was like, oh, there was like, I was like, oh, I have my like tattoo, my like Hall & Oates tattoo, and it was like, here's my thing. I love a lot of their songs, but I actually don't need to hear Rich Girl ever again.
Interesting.
I don't like it.
I was wondering if maybe you were going to say the one that went viral in that video like 15 years ago, Making My Dreams Come True or whatever.
Oh, I love that one.
Okay,
though.
You can keep that one going. All right. You know, I love all
one thing about one thing about my dreams. I'd like them to come true.
Okay, that's what I'll remember about those. no, I was going to also say, speaking of them, after last week when I said I'm still a fan of Charlie Puth, his Hall & Oates-iness, he came out with a song that is good.
Lipstick.
Yeah, love it.
It's a very good song.
He does call women bitches in it. Unfortunately, he's in a genre I call rhythm and douche, and you just have to expect that sometimes, okay? Misogyny is part of the game. Sorry.
You know what? Like, he's he's trying to be like, you know, like a white Tupac, like a white Biggie, you know, he's like, you know,
acceptable white Tupac.
These bitches be doing it, you know, and these bitches gotta know. I was one of the funniest like tweets I saw about it was he had like tweeted like lipstick out now. And someone was like, Rihanna, when you want new music from her.
So good.
But it is good. It's like sultry. It's sexy.
Yes,
I like it.
He lost the sultriness before and he's gotten it back. Anyway, let's get back to these questions. One of them is from one of my favorite follows on Twitter, Wonderkind87. Hi, Yannick. What are the best worst TV shows based on a movie and best worst movies based on a TV show? Best worst TV shows based on a movie. God. That's really hard. The other way, I think The Fugitive is one of the best movies based on a TV show. It's also a Best Picture nominee, which it was the first at the time that kind of adaptation to get a Best Picture nominee.
Yeah, I would say that I feel...
Ooh, the Mission Impossible movies, of course, too.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And also, I mean, it's based off a Martin Landau, Barbara Bain series that we have a blockbuster universe based off that I should be very thankful about.
Listen... my friend, my girl was on the show and the show got canceled for a reason because I will say a TV version of True Lies, what were we doing?
Who was in that? Oh, no.
Ginger.
From a couple of weeks. Yes, of course. Yes, yeah, right. I saw it.
what were we doing? Yeah. She was like, what am I doing? She was just collecting a check. I know that. Because it's like true lies. It's just like the thing about True Lies for me. Here's the thing about like adapting a movie into a TV show. A movie, like the movie is sort of like the movie can be good and the movie can have a good concept. But the thing about a movie is that like it also captures like a cult, like Barbie is so big because it's like a cultural moment, yeah, right? Uh-huh. You know, and like the reason True Lies is so big is because it involves like Jamie Lee Curtis is like doing like the strip tease and like that sexiness there. It's just like it's interesting and fun because Jamie Lee Curtis is in it doing this part. Like you sell movies based on the movie star who you're going to see doing something. So when you adapt a movie that people famously liked for a certain reason into a TV show with like other actors who have never been like in that thing, it's like it's never going to translate because you're never going to be able to recreate that moment that was it, you know? And like,
yeah, that movie was defined by star power for sure, definitely.
Heathers. Need I say more?
Yeah. I thought the direction of Heathers was the worst part, actually. It's like you could hear the funny jokes in there, but they weren't landing. It's like every joke was in outer space or something. Let's see here. Here's a good one from The Professor. Favorite song from an artist you overall don't like? I mean, this is shady right off the bat. I'm trying to think of somebody who do I hate and yet tolerate every once in a while? Well, I'll say this. I obviously don't roll with, like, dad music, generally speaking, or rock music is not really what I listen to. That said, if you put on Do It Again by Steely Dan, honey, I feel like dancing and put like flipping burgers and, you know, shaking it in the yard.
You don't like Steely Dan?
I mean, I like some, I like Brooklyn, the song Brooklyn by Steely Dan, but I'm not like a careerist of theirs. I don't know everything they've ever done.
First of all, whenever we get on this podcast, you're basically reeling in the years.
Ricky, don't 1973,
who can I talk Lewis, about? Okay. Yeah. And it's like, oh.
It's not that bringing I hate up them.
bringing up Charlotte Rampling, you're like, do it again. Okay, here I will say, like, and listen, she's like, she's got some bops, a couple, but like Meghan Trainor.
I was gonna bring up her.
not really our girl.
Yeah.
But the song No.
I was gonna say No is definitely her best song, and you put that on, like, now I'm on a treadmill.
It's a bop. And yeah. Also that's a song where it's like, give it to like any of the like other pop girls, and like people would have been standing it.
Can I say something? Just provocative. I know people don't want me to bring up Taylor Swift. I know they've had it. But let me simply say something. In the Reputation era, when she has that song, is it Endgame? And she's like, ooh, you and me got a big reputation. Nah.
She does.
And you heard about
Big reputation. Big reputation. Ooh, you and me, we got big conversation. Oh, and you heard about me?
How is that different from Meghan Trainor? How is that different? The
Meghan Trainor's never booked Future.
Okay. I'm just saying, it feels like the thing that people consider cringe about her is like rad about Taylor Swift. Okay, moving on. I don't want to get in there. I'm going to be shot. Okay.
Also, Meghan doesn't have a reputation.
Right. She
because
can't
no one
sing
talks
that.
About her.
Seems like a nice girl. She has, as a mother. Remember that song? Oh, here's an interesting one. Ungraceful G says, who are the most boring celebrities that Hollywood keeps pushing? I mean, my answer would be most of them. People are like perpetually boring now. You know, people don't want to, they're not pot stirrers. They're not going to give you an interview like Noah Galvin did that one time where he's like, let me call out every bad person in Hollywood. Noah Galvin, bring that back.
I love Noah. And that was honestly one of the worst crimes against a celebrity that was ever committed. Like, when he said all that wild shit in that Vulture interview, and then everybody was like, oh no, you need to walk that back. No, and I was like, someone was finally being fucking interesting and talking about like what you all say anyway. And it's like, oh, okay, you can't drag Bryan Singer?
Right.
Like, yeah, you're really looking for a Valkyrie sequel? Yeah.
You know I've been waiting. I think Tom can really nail it this time.
Boring celebrity. You know what? I don't know if this is boring, but there are like a couple songs that I sort of have liked of Phoebe Bridgers. Mm. But I will say that overall, she's kind of boring. And I saw a tweet the other day where someone was like, people have been sort of getting like misogynistic with her because like she broke up with like a beloved actor like Paul Mescal. And I was just sort of like, honestly, he's kind of boring too. And I feel like the internet likes him because he's like, he's hot and like he's Irish. He has a little accent. And we saw him like fucking in Normal People.
Sure.
But like, other than that,
great
like,
actor. Yeah.
Great. Listen, you know, young actor,
yeah.
Young performer.
Yes.
After Sun.
Of course.
Was ready to turn it off.
Yeah.
And I did turn it off because it wasn't good and I didn't like it. And I think that both of them are kind of boring. And people were like, oh, people were dragging her because, like, maybe she, like, broke up with Paul Mescal to, like, be with Bo Burnham, whatever. And I'm like, it's the maybe of it all that is so boring, okay? Like, Ariana Grande is out here as, like, you know, tip, tip, tip on, you know, cheater floors, okay? Like, she's adulterating all over the place.
Yeah.
And
stepping
people
out,
are standing her.
In. Yeah, right.
Girl, people are, like, standing her. And I'm like, people are standing Angelina Jolie. And it's like, yes, I understand that, like, this bullshit misogyny that is always, like, thrown at celebrities
sure.
and stuff, but it's also just like the entire thing about her and Paul, like that maybe relationship, whatever. It was just like all a lot of maybes, and it was never really confirmed, and it all just felt very like, oh, you're sort of interested because these people are pretty and like whatever. And it's like, I don't know. Bridges over troubled water. I'm bored.
Okay, Phoebe Bridges. Sorry, what's the name of that boy genius, right? She's in that group.
Yes.
Okay. That album was pimped to me 100,000 times. I'm not saying it wasn't, like, good. And I think the three of them have a fun dynamic together. They performed on Kimmel one time. I watched them in the audience. I don't know that I was obsessed with it. I sort of missed I didn't really get it. That's all I'll say.
Boy genius. The only boy genius I know is the smart guy.
I'm going to say, what about Dexter, honey? Yeah.
Oh, well, him too. Yeah.
Honey, we're in the laboratory now. It's Cartoon Network and it's 1999, bitch. Here's one from Instagram that but what is your favorite TV show of the past 5 years? You know what I think I would say? First of all, my mind immediately goes to a limited series space, which I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. I feel like maybe that's where the best TV has been, in limited series over the past few years. I think I would say Mayor of Easttown is my favorite show of the past five. Just a traditional mystery with one exceptional performance that I did not expect. Did I ever expect Kate Winslet to go to Pittsburgh, know what that is, be able to spell Pittsburgh? No. She's married to somebody whose last name is Rock and Roll. Her life is crazy. So for her to make this show, and I thought it was so good. I even like the end of the mystery, which if you look at the history of the mystery genre in movies, rarely are there good endings to mystery movies. You know,
that's true. That's true. They're usually bad. They're usually bad. Honestly, I know there's like a lot of limited series and things. But if I'm talking like a series that, you know, has had like a couple seasons and like more is to come, P-Valley.
Mm.
I fucking love it.
Yes.
fucking love it. And I think it's really good. And I would like more people to be watching. Like we're on like the strike, like the writer's strike. It's like more people should be watching P-Valley. Evan Ross Counts, watch P-Valley and like put some memes up from that. Okay, like instead of just like White Lotus and just like that, because I'm tired of them white women. Like P-Valley, the girls are popping their pussy and serving.
People don't know the show. It's on Stars, and it's about a strip joint. And the characters are fabulous. We had the creator on years and years ago. Jeez,
Katori Hall. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. The great Katori
Hall. I just think it's like a really good show. And I think it's just like it's written beautifully. The characters feel very real. And then also like there's the athleticism of just seeing like, you know, the whipping, you know, like doing their thing.
Which, you know, I don't get to see in real life because I don't go to those kinds of clubs. So it's actually an anthropological show for me.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Most disappointing celeb industry encounter. I can think of one because I thought it was going to be amazing. So I was at the TCAs, which is where, I've explained this before, it's where twice a year TV shows trot out their casts, and then like the media gets to interview them, ask questions of the creators, whatever. It's when shows are introduced to the universe. It's sort of an old model of television. But anyway, one time, years and years and years ago, Mamie Gummer, the daughter of Meryl Streep, was in a Shondaland show called Off the Map. And, you know, I'm excited to talk to Mamie Gummer, whatever, right? Because, you know, as a reporter. Shockingly, I'm walking through the hallway and Mamie Gummer sees me and walks up to me. She's walking at me. This is the daughter of Meryl Streep.
Okay, she's gumming.
Yeah, she's gumming. Right? She's smacking her gums together. Yeah. She comes in, up to me, puts her hand on my shoulder and goes, "Your fly is down." That is among my worst moments. And by the way, you know my underwear was like fruity and faggoty. So like, so she got a glimpse. And I was like, wait, stop. Your mom has 21 Oscar nominations. Talk to me. How about you?
Honestly, okay, so this is going to be messy, but whatever.
Okay, hit it.
That's who we are. So, like, I was at the SNL after party once, and I met John Hamm.
Oh, sure.
And I was like, you know, I'm friends with Kiernan, you know? So, like, we chatted about it. We record, like, a video and sent it to her, you know?
Cute.
And it was, like, a few months before, like, then I did Wild Jet Happens Live.
Oh, right. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes. And John Hamm was on it with John Slattery. And then...
You were the bartender, yes.
Just stabbing me and my ego. John Hamm came up to me and said, "Nice to meet you."
Oh, that's too bad. You can't expect celebrities to remember people, though. You know.
I know. You can't expect them to remember it. But I was like, we turned up!
You shouldn't have burst into tears right then. You're like, I sat through tag for you.
Honestly, I did watch Tag.
Is it okay?
It's good. I liked Tag. You know what else I watch it? I watched that Fletch movie.
Right. No.
I watched it on Delta. Okay. You listen, I watched it on Delta 4 vodka cranberries in and on an edible. So that I was living.
No, wait. Jeremy Renner is
it could have been Tar.
Right? Yes. Yeah.
It could have been Tar.
Do you know a movie I had never seen and I finally watched last week? Do you know North Country with Charlize Theron and Frances McDormand? Anyway, it's about like women and they work in mines in Minnesota and they're being harassed on the job by these other
I know
workers.
Of it.
Okay, right.
Never a film that I intend on watching.
I had a couple hours and I went for it the other day.
I love Charlize Africa.
Right.
But I don't want to watch her doing that.
Jeremy Renner is in it being absolutely disgusting. It's actually an awesome performance, but he's so gross. It's like, oh, like I can't believe that was the Jeremy Renner we got pre Hurt Locker. Like he really transformed in the public eye.
You know what's kind of wild? I feel like maybe he took like a different turn with like his public persona and like doing like the Hawkeye-ness of it all. Uh-huh. But like he really could have been like eating Casey Affleck's food.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
He's very Casey Affleck. And I honestly think that, like, in a world where, like, he was putting a bit more effort into it, like, Jeremy Renner would be, like, he'd be better than Casey Affleck. Because the problem is that, like, Casey Affleck is, like, actually a really good actor.
Every movie I've ever seen him in, he's great.
He's fucking amazing. And I feel like Jeremy Renner could have really been doing that. But, you know, he was busy making apps.
Yeah, what a mysterious trip. Of course, he's recovering from a serious accident also. But you're right. He could be playing like blue-collar heroes, you know, for right. all of us. Your turn, Ira. Do you have a question?
I do. This one is just for you, Lewis.
Okay.
The Beths. I'm trying to pronounce that correctly. The Beth ST wants to know top 5 Jane Fonda performances.
Holy shit.
I mean,
shit.
And for me, I'm going to be like, a girl monster-in-law.
I know, right.
So
as Jane herself said, whenever black people come up to me, it's monster-in-law. Didn't she say that?
She was doing it.
Yeah.
She was doing it. She was doing it, okay?
Okay.
Come on.
I would say my favorite Jane Fonda performance is her first nomination, which is They Shoot Horses, Don't They? I talk about that performance all the time on this podcast, which is takes place in a dance marathon in the 30s. She comes in. She's this hardened bitch who needs to, like, compete in this horrible pageant in order to make money. And it's one of the most cynical movies ever, but it's my favorite performance of hers. Second favorite, I would go Clute, which she won her first Oscar for. She's a call girl in New York,
mm-hmm.
With Donald Sutherland, another actor we love. Next one would be Julia, which is where she plays Lillian Hellman, one of the playwright and renowned liar, who just made up this entire lark about her life that turned into this movie where she goes and has this childhood friend who becomes this kind of revolutionary, and it's about their friendship. Lillian Hellman didn't have a friend like that.
I heard The Children's Hour was actually only 20 minutes.
You exaggerate and it becomes an hour. Yes. let's see. I love Jane in The China Syndrome next, where she plays a TV reporter who stumbles on a big nuclear meltdown. And then the last one, she was in a movie a few years ago where she reunited with Robert Redford called Our Souls at Night. So good. It's on Netflix. And it's written by the people who did, I think, The Disaster Artist, Scott Neustadter, whom I love. He's on Twitter. Yeah, so I think that's the five I would pick.
Okay, great. Film.sorbet wants to know, what movies deserve to have their own themed restaurant?
Wow. Let's see here. A movie I'm re-obsessed with recently. Have you ever seen Party Girl with Parker Posey? Have we talked about this?
Come on, baby. You know, I'm at the park. Okay. Like I'm parking.
Park
okay. I have my parking pass.
I just think it's one of the funniest performances ever. So that immediately came to mind.
And so early in her career.
Yeah. But also during that like indie time where she's doing like 14 movies a year. That just came to mind because I want like a 90s queerish themed restaurant with like a dizzy hostess who's drunk and getting arrested. How about you?
You bringing up Parker is funny because like, you know, I was recently rewatching Scream 3 because the original unedited cut leaked online. And so I was watching that and it's fucking great. Basically, it's like, it's the same movie, but it's longer and there's like the kills are more brutal. Like they spend more time in like the scenes and stuff. But like it feels like a real lived in movie that Wes Craven would have made. And then it was just fucking edited to hell so it could be like, you know, 30 minutes shorter. But yeah,
that movie feels very chopped to me. Yes.
Yeah. But I feel like a Scream restaurant would be fun.
Oh, of course. How does this not already happen? How am I not walking down Universal City Walk and Ghostface isn't ushering me to my table?
Also, a Dick Tracy restaurant would be great.
I mean, it would be better than the movie, which I famously do not like. Though I do love Madonna in it. Yeah.
You know I love that movie.
I just think it's, like The Simpsons, one of the ugliest things we've ever put on TV. Put more yellow in front of me.
Well, I mean, I thought you were talking about all the gangster villains in it because the faces are ugly.
Oh, my God. I just saw some promo shots of Al Pacino and Madonna, like, boogieing down together, and he's in all the prosthetics. Woof. Guys, I mean, I can't just look at that. It's just so ugly. It's so ugly.
Girl, it's giving Grindr at 4 a.m. Yeah. Okay? It is. It is.
It's giving Steamworks at 4 a.m. Yeah.
Okay, give me another question.
Okay, sure. And here's our last question. This is from Luxury Trash. What often maligned Oscar win will you defend with your dying breath? We haven't talked Oscars yet. This is a good question.
I know. Maligned Oscar win. Actually, someone had asked in one of the questions that we didn't get to, they had asked, why has Tom Wilkinson never won an Oscar?
Fabulous
actor.
They're
like, he's great in the Bedroom and Michael Clayton.
Right.
But I will say the In the Bedroom year was the Training Day year, and I will defend Denzel winning for Training Day any day of the week. I think he fucking kills in that role. And I think people are like, you know, like it was one of those like we're going to give him the Oscar because like he didn't get it for Malcolm X. But it was just like he is living that fucking role. Like Training Day is his movie.
Good answer. Good answer. Because you're right. That did feel like a career win at the time. Even though, of course, he had won for Glory, but that's a supporting win. And therefore, doesn't matter.
No.
I will go with...
Julia was like, you're going to give that man another Oscar. My Denzel?
Man, I love them together. Can we get that going again?
Girl, where's the Pelican Brief too?
Please. Your lips to God's ears.
The Pelican Briefs. Yeah. The Pelican Boxers.
That was among the dumbest comments I've ever heard of the show. And believe me, I've ranked them. I'm going to go with Elizabeth Taylor's first win in Butterfield 8. That's a movie that, talk about it. She had been through it by that time. Famously, her husband died in a plane crash. She was sick. People thought we might be nearing the end of Elizabeth Taylor's life. Ooh, were they wrong? But this movie is basically considered a camp classic. And the reason it's considered campy is because of the opening scene where she's writing on this mirror and lipstick. And at the end of the movie, it culminates in this chase scene that feels very tonally disparate from the rest of the movie. But the rest
By the way, that lipstick scene has influenced so much of gay culture.
Oh, like, yeah. Like it's definitely RuPaul's Drag Race. Yeah.
RuPaul's Drag Race. And then also Which Diana Ross film?
Is it Mahogany?
I think it may be Mahogany, where like she's writing on there. Yeah. Like that is, it's just like the lipstick writing on like the mirror, like that is iconic.
Totally. Though.
It's just like, it's in there. And people don't really know it's from Butterfield 8.
And also, but in the movie, her line readings are so deadly and she is so funny. It really is a reward for a star performance. And really, when you look back at the history of Oscar wins, not too many wins that are, oh, here's just a star giving us everything, as opposed to like a compelling or gritty or real performance. You know, like you don't get like an Oscar win for like a Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman. You get an Oscar win for Julia Roberts, you know, fighting for a community in Erin Brockovich. So I really applaud not just the performance itself, but the kind of performance it is. You know, it's like if Tom Cruise won an Oscar or something.
I mean, listen, you know, I will always advocate for like Tom winning, you know, for like, obviously, you know, like his best role, like Magnolia, like that. But like, I would have advocated for Tom winning for an Oscar for like Jerry Maguire too. Like,
totally.
I am always on the side of rewarding an actor for a star performance. I don't think it always needs to be a very serious, like we're doing like a film, you know? I'm like, you're a star, you are delivering, you are also like, the reason why this movie is a hit, the reason why people love it is your performance. Like, you made the movie.
Yeah,
you
right.
made the hit, you made the box office. That is what we should be rewarding.
Right. And weirdly that year, Jeffrey Rush, a Best Actor winner. It's just so interesting. Like that, you know, it's so like...
Girl.
You don't talk about Shine that much. Why?
We don't talk about her. Jeffrey Rush? Jeffrey slowed down, okay? She's still making them Pirates movies.
He's really good in Shakespeare in Love, though.
He is really good. I'm not dragging Jeffrey Rush down. I mean, he's a great actor, but, you know, like, I think we talked about this on the show before. No, don't nobody give a fuck about Shine. And no one cared about it when that came out. That's giving payola. It's giving slander. It's giving attack against Tom Cruise. It's like no one was watching Shine. Who has seen that movie?
It's like, no, there are a couple Oscar wins back there, like James Coburn winning for Affliction. Are we sure that's a movie? Because I haven't seen it.
Right. They're like, okay, before we wrap up, like this, like, give me like another one where it's like, truly, like, someone won, like, one for a movie, and, like, I mean, like, I'm sure you've seen it because, like, you know, like, you
yeah, I have a disease.
Love the
I have
institution, and you're supporting it, but it's just, like...
It's like Jim Broadbent and Iris.
Yeah.
Sure?
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, movies where it's, like, nobody saw that shit.
Right. Okay, we'll be on the case for this next time. Movies that turned out not to be real. But anyway.
Yeah.
Should we introduce our guest now?
Yes. We will be right back with the wild party... Lee talented Idina Menzel.
Very good.
You see what I did there?
Yep.
Yeah. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR and how I live my life every day.
Oh, I'm glad to bear witness to it.
Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of a struggle.
It sounds like you at Coachella. I'm already tuned in. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective, from Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations. There's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths.
Black perspectives have always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and Black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us.
Doesn't the Black experience sound like a 3-disc Prince album we never got? Someone check the vault, please. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to our studio, where we have a special guest with us today, Toucan Sam from Fruit Loops. Toucan Sam, welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here. Oh, and it's Fruit Loops, just so you know.
Fruit?
Fruit.
Yeah, fruit.
No, it's Fruit Loops. The same way you say studio.
That's not how we say it.
Fruit Loops, find the loopy side.
Here you are, BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Our guest today is an actress, singer, songwriter, uncut gem, Broadway icon, and a voice your kids can't get ready, let go of. Her new album, a dance album, Drama Queen, is out now. Welcome to Keep It, the magnificent and incomparable, and of course, Tony winning, Idina Menzel.
Thank you. Thank you. Can I bring you over here with me for that introduction?
Sure. Oh, please. I'll be like a little carnival barker for Idina Menzel. That'd be fun. Now, I want to say I first saw you perform a song off this new album at the GLAAD Awards a couple months ago. I mean, not that this would be a new experience for you, but what is it like performing for, you know, a room full of, I'll say it, haughty and elite gay people?
Now, did you say haughty or haughty?
You know what? It's a little bit of both. I have to say there's a Venn diagram mix there.
It's thrilling to perform for haughty, and hilarious, and trying to think of another H. That's really good.
Mm. Hellish, yes.
Heartfelt. The thing about the Pride festivals, like, it's different than from, you know, doing a show, a Broadway show or something. We're even singing at like a performing arts center because everyone's packed up against the stage. You know, I can literally touch people. They're right there. I can see them. They're not like sitting politely in their seat, you know, ready for the overture to begin. And they're rowdy and they're beautiful and they're emotional. And I can, you know, hold the mic out and they sing songs and, I've had dancers now, which I held off on having dancers for a long time. I thought, I'm not really a good dancer, and I don't really see myself as like the next Janet Jackson or whatever. but there's something about having a few dancers around you that brings some good stuff out of you. And if you're a singer, people don't expect me to dance a certain part because they want me to ground myself and sing the big notes. So the expectations are low. It's kind of like when Whitney Houston was doing it, you know, like, not to compare myself to my total idol of Whitney Houston, but you know, like when you're singing, you don't have to be the great, we know that she wasn't the best dancer, you know? So you can just do a little like side step, step together with a bunch of hot dancers doing stuff around you and you look like a goddess.
There's also something actually about pop singers doing less dancing than the people around them that's a little bit glamorous too, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like I delivered the message and somebody else performs the emotion. Exactly.
Very Jessie Ware, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I leaned into it, you know, like this new album's called Drama Queen and one of my favorite songs on it's called Dramatic. And I leaned into it. I wore rainbow colored puffer jacket that was like 15 feet long. And the guys were kind of like my bridesmaids, and they held it out behind me. And I worked it. It was 100 degrees out, and I wore that puffer coat.
I mean, I guess it's not shocking to hear, you know, that you're like, you know, like you're not a dancer, but did you ever find that dancing was something that you were like, is this something I want to be interested in when you were doing Broadway? Or were you just like, you know what, I'm going to be the singer, and I am never going to do a show where like you required me to, you know, be dancing, you know, okay. I'm not doing anything goes.
Okay. So I danced, and I was on toe shoes for 1 year when I was 12, and I realized toe shoes are loud and not graceful sounding at all. But you can't hear it. You can't hear it when there's an orchestra or it's on PBS special or whatever, but it's like clonk, 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 clonk. It's not, you don't feel graceful. That and my boobs coming out was like, I'm done with this. And then I was always just, you know, I could move. Okay. But I never say never. I will do what anyone needs me to do. And if the role is great, but I also don't want to, you know, be delusional, but if it's something I need to do, I will require, and I have required tutoring from usually the assistant choreographer, who is a wonderful job it is to take me into the room, the B studio on the side, and try to get me to learn 8 counts in 4 hours. I can't get the memory thing. You know what I mean? I can't pick it up fast. Even when I was younger, I couldn't like 5, 6, 7, 8. You got it, everybody? Now go. Like chorus line. That gives me so much anxiety.
No, there's a real like the fluency factor to dance that is different, I feel like, than other forms of entertainment.
Yeah, not good. But it's funny, in a lot of bios I see about myself, it always calls me a triple threat, which I think is so funny because I'm not, but I'm sometimes they just say I'm a triple threat because I write my own music. So that's like my other, but in Broadway terms, that's BS, you know.
I was thinking about how your new music, which is dance music, some of it, the producers on this album, including like Nile Rodgers, I mean, you really got like the mavens of dance involved in this. If I had to connect it to what I consider your familiar catalog, I guess it would remind me most thematically of Life of the Party from The Wild Party. And I've always wondered if that song specifically spoke to you and, you know, your spirit when you're performing.
It's funny that you brought up that song because I used to perform it a lot with orchestras and my own concerts. And then I haven't sung it in years. And then the first single was coming out, and I went, what was the bar that we went to out in Brooklyn? What was it called? And we showed up and we hung out with everybody and we played the new music. I'm forgetting right now the name of the bar. I'll get it. And I'm one of the performers that night lip-synced to Wild Party and tried to get me up there to sing it. And I couldn't remember any of the words or couldn't even sing the high notes. I didn't know what I was doing. But so that was random that you just brought that up. So I recall that character, Kate, was quite a drunk and was probably super depressed if it was the 1920s or so. So she didn't have her Prozac to fall back on.
But, right. You've done the dramaturgical research on this. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I'd like to say they're connected, but I think they're actually on opposite sides of the spectrum. So, because I saw that character as being kind of dark and wounded and very desperate. And Drama Queen is like a celebration, I hope. And it's joyful and it's party and in that way. And it's also an album where I'm thinking less about, I spent less time overthinking and trying to contemplate what was the expectations people had of me and what kind of music I just want to do because I want to do it and I love it and it'll be fun to perform. And if I'm being honest, the only thing I gave real thought to or deliberated was But this music, dance, disco music, really lends itself to big voices. So I could really sing the way I love to sing. I don't need to hold back and make it more vibey or to fit in with the pop sounds of today or whatever. If you embrace the nostalgia and the retro of that time, you know, it's Donna Summer, it's Gloria Gaynor, it's Diana Ross, it's Barbra Streisand when she did her, you know,
No dance. More tears. Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's like, so we can do that, you know, and we can bring the drama and it can still cross over and be cool and you can still dance to it. And then when Cher came back later with her whole dance album, you know what I mean? So that was sort of what gave me, I felt like I had permission to do that. And I called Mal Rogers, honestly, and said, do I have permission? Is this okay? And he was like, yeah, let's get started.
I was angry at Lewis for bringing up the Wild Party before I could. I love the Lipa version, obviously. And what was interesting is we recently had Toni Collette here, and I asked her, like, if she remembered anything from that era where she was in the other Wild Party, and yep, where there are two Wild Parties going on in New York.
Yep.
Do you remember, like, anything from that moment of just, you know, like, either friends or, like, people being like, wait, am I sure I'm going to see yours? Did I accidentally go and see this other one, like, across, you know, 8th Avenue or something? Like, what was that like, just being in a show where, like, there's also literally another one happening now?
I remember feeling badly for the creators, for Andrew Lippa and for Michael John, because, you know, they were creating their own thing for years, and all of a sudden it comes out at the same time. You know how that happens every once in a while. It's like, so I just felt badly for them, but we were like the little off-Broadway lower budget version. And they were the big Broadway version. And all of us got bad reviews, so it didn't really matter. And my fondest memory of that time was my relationship to the cast, because it was, you know, off Broadway. We were all girls. We're in one one dressing room, like a chorus dressing room, everybody together, and the guys were like just a curtain away. I guess it wasn't very gender friendly back then, was it? Girls and boys dressing room, but. I remember that we all were super close because of that, because we were sharing the space together. And we said, okay, if we don't get a rave from Ben Brantley and the Times and we're not like moving to Broadway, then let's also book a trip together that we all get on a plane 2 days later in case, you know, and we did. We booked a trip to the Dominican Republic and we all went away together. We drank our sorrows and yeah. And I remember the review. I don't know why I'm bringing it up in this interview, but I remember what he said about me in that review. And it always bothered me, obviously, because I'm bringing it up now. he called me shrill. It always bothered me because I thought, well, there's a difference between being projecting, having a big, belty voice, you know, being shrill. And so I think that stuck with me. And I don't know whether I really believed it was true in that show or not, but I always sort of think about that and how to make sure that really like coming from a grounded place, no matter what dynamic it is, you know, that it like, you're not just angry or expressing to like be sarcastic or angry. That's always coming from a warmth, an experience. I don't know. I'm not really expressing this very well, but kind of feel like shrill means disconnected, and you can like when you're mad at someone, you know, they hear you and they're, you could say it really loud, but you can say like, are we allowed to curse on this?
Oh so, yes.
Yeah. Like, we do all the time.
You fucking asshole. Don't walk out the door, you know, but if you're like, you fucking asshole, don't walk out the door, that's very shrill and nobody's listening to you. So I kind of put that into singing too. Be like, you fucking asshole, don't put out the door, you know what I mean? I'm not making any sense. I'm a little delirious, but there's something to that.
I associate you with, of course, Broadway, and now like all these like dance stages you'll be taking over the summer promoting this album. But I also, of course, think of you as you perform so many times at like the Oscars or the Tonys or all these times where there are these one-off moments where everybody's watching. Do you have a favorite one-off performance you've ever done that maybe was on TV or something, and just the reception you got? Was there any one, like award show, for example, that stands out?
The one-off moments are the worst. Because you never can feel completely comfortable in your surroundings, the sound that you're hearing, your microphone, what's slapping back at you. You know, when you're on the road or you're on doing 8 shows a week or whatever, and play, you're used to what you hear, you know, and you can start to get comfortable and everything. Have fun. And you know what you're wearing, and you're used to it. If you're wearing heels or you're not wearing heels, and you're in your tight dress or you're not, or a weird costume, you're used to it, you know. The one-off things, usually I wear something so I feel really good, really high heels, tall, so I can feel thin. And then I'm like teetering on my heels. And then the sound's weird, and you just can't like enjoy yourself, you know. So that was the first thing that came to my mind when you asked me was, no, never. like another time when I did with Wicked, I was on David Letterman. First time David Letterman in my whole life. I always watched him growing up. And they put me up in we had this levitating device thing, you know, on Broadway. It was this hydraulic thing, and you get in, you strap yourself into this thing to make sure that the computer said, oh, she's safe, she's in, she's locked, now it's going to go up. And on Letterman, they just used like one of those camera cranes, you know, to put me in and just like, woo, which in a way it kind of worked, and it was probably a lot less money than what the producers ended up using for Wicked all these years. But I remember being hoisted up going, it's me, and going up there, and then they just left me up there. And then they go into commercial. You know, David Letterman usually comes over and shakes your hand. And says, hey, he couldn't shake. I couldn't even shake his hand because I'm up in this thing. And I'm like, hi, Dave. You know, stuck up there. Like every time is just something a little unexpected. And then, you know, the Oscars, that was a fiasco for me. So it's like, I'm trying to think of a good experience. Another time I was doing New Year's Eve. They're all bad. New Year's Eve, Times Square. I decided I was not going to lip sync a song for that. And I wanted people to know I don't lip sync. I do it, even though it's 0 degrees and a lot of people sing to track because it's just so cold on New Year's Eve at Times Square. And I said, no, I'm going to do it in its original key. People are going to know. And then I got up there. I was wearing those heaters you wear when you're skiing, you know, and like under my boobs and on my back and on my hands. And I looked heavy because I had so many layers on. And then I got to the last note and I totally cracked. And then everyone wrote about how bad I was. So thanks for bringing this up.
It's like a trick I'm playing or something. No, I mean, like, I'm a huge fan of The Carpenters, for example. And they performed at the Oscars once a song called For All We Know. And I, like, historically, that's like one of the lowest moments for them. Like, it sounded so bad.
Why?
Ultimately. And then
they
just like, it's the sound was horrible. They couldn't hear themselves. And the next time they performed at the Oscars, it was a complete lip sync, which you never think about with Karen Carpenter.
So. Yeah.
So you're in good company.
And then you feel bad for Milli Vanilli. I mean, look at those four.
they looked amazing. You know what I mean?
They got such shit for that. And you know, everybody just does it.
What I want to ask, too, about this album is, obviously, I feel like the thing that everyone's talking about is you're making TikToks for the album.
Sure are.
You are on the app. Every time I'm scrolling, you're popping up in my For You page. And I want to know, are you coming up with like, were you just like, I actually like making a TikTok? Or are you just like, you know, I'm doing this to promote the music. You know, it's what I got to do. Or are you like, you know, are you like on TikTok daily now that you're making content for it? Like, are you scrolling? Are you watching things?
It's a little of all of that, I would say. And so the first reaction was, what? Nobody cares about what I'm doing in my refrigerator, taking out a gallon of milk and then singing my song. Like, what is that? That's how you want me to promote the music? Or like, you know, but then I end up having fun doing it. Then I get a little too care too much about whether it's being seen. See, that's the thing about it.
Mm.
You get sucked into this, you know, who likes me, who doesn't like me, how many people decided to, you know, all that. So, but then I also want to see what actually is more viral or what just sinks, you know. It's the weirdest thing. The ones I spend the most time on, I don't get that many views. And then the ones that's just like, hey, you know, in my kitchen and my dog walked by, is like, you know, millions of views. Like, seriously? So
I feel like it rewards that, though. Like, I feel like the ones that I always see, and maybe even the ones that I feel like I'm stopping and watching of anybody on TikTok, it's always just someone like, they're walking down the street and they just decided to say something quickly, or like, you know, like they're in their car or something. It feel like it rewards very like
fleetingness.
Off the cuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's so, I can't think of the word, but it's contradicted to the idea of needing to make sure things are perfect because everybody sees you at every minute of the day now. So it's like, not only is everyone seeing you, but you have to not have makeup and make mistakes in order for it to be good. But if you do something that's a little wrong, or you spell your caption wrong or do something like that, and then someone goes, oh my God, she wrote vain instead of vain, V-A-I-N instead of V. You know, it's this. So I can't even caption it without spending 3 hours on my grammar, you know. And then by that time, I just hand it over to Gio, who's here, my good friend, who's my hair and makeup. I'm like, can you please tag whoever's supposed to be friggin' tagged in this? Because by the time I do it, I will have And then my son thinks it's all lame. He thinks, like, that all the stuff I'm doing is just that he needs to be paid to be my TikTok, you know, advisor. So...
Do you at all miss, like, the Broadway world before social media? Like, I feel like that's a time that's now extremely romanticized to me. You know, just like, it was a community and you went to go hang out and it really didn't have anything to do with, oh, I'm watching this, like, video of you at a bar or whatever. You know, it was really a be in with each other thing. Yeah. And that's how you experience Broadway.
Well, that's what I mean. You know, it's about live performance. And live performance isn't perfect all the time. That's what actually makes it so... thrilling and you know, compelling and really speaks to you and deep in your soul, or you get goosebumps. It's not because it's perfect. So that I resent it because I feel like now everyone's phones, even if they sneak them, you know, if they hear you on a matinee on a Wednesday and my kid had a fever the night before and he's snotty and I decide I'm going to snuggle with my kid and not, you know, quarantine myself because I have a show to do. And then I come down and I'm congested as can be and losing my voice, but I'm up there because I don't want to call in sick. And then someone hears a bad note and then it's everywhere. And then they say, she's not really, someone can do the role better than her, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's just, it's not for the faint of heart, you know, and I've never been one that really could say I don't care what people think of me, because I do. So
I will say, though, as not social media and phones, but, you know, as a you know, someone with a theater degree who grew up, like, you know, like loving theater and being in Milwaukee and then Chicago, I first was introduced to you from, like, they definitely weren't cell phones at the time. They had to be someone using a small camcorder, but a Rent bootleg and a Wicked bootleg. And you sounded great on the ones that I saw.
I don't know. That's the other thing. Is with autotune being this thing that everyone uses, no matter what now, in the studio, just it's a producer's tool. I think people's ears are... They're hearing perfection of a note. I don't mean to get too, like, inside, you know, recording, but it's just things have to be right down the middle. If there's a little flat, a little sharp, which is what makes us human, it's, I think people just, their ears are not, they don't hear that anymore. They're used to this very specific sound. And So I don't know, maybe it's because I go back and I listen. I think, oh my God, how did I sing like that? But no one would have heard it that way back then because it was just was normal. Now everything's like Kanye West's album when he did that. Was that when he first came out with all that auto-tune stuff on it?
Oh, 808's Heartbreaks. Yeah. I want to ask one last question. Speaking of, I brought up Rent. I first discovered that in high school, and then obviously, you know, I saw the bootleg, like I said, and then was finally able to see a touring version, and then I was able to see the film, and I feel like it's had such a long life, and people still love this show, and there's so many iconic songs in it, but what would you say is the song that maybe from Rent that pops into your head the most, or you see that people maybe bring up the most? I feel like usually it's like Seasons of Love, like mm-hmm. you'll have like at like maybe like a important moment, you know, like mm-hmm. someone's performing it on a show or something. But I have to tell you, like Take Me or Leave Me, I see done all the time. People are always performing that. And I feel like, is that the one that like you hear about from people the most, or is that what comes into your mind the most from the show?
Well, it's hard for me because when I go on tour, I do that song. I do a couple mm-hmm. things. And that's one of the songs I do. And I go in the audience and I recruit people. And for better or worse, you know, we discover some amazing people and some we don't. But so I do it all the time. So it's in my, I mean, it was in my DNA because we created it. But, you know, it's just always around me. The song that I also do all the time that I never get tired of singing is I came up with my own arrangement of No Day But Today. Which song, I wasn't a part of that scene, my character. I was in the finale part of it, but in the actual show. But I just always loved that song so much. It was one of my favorite songs. And so I do an arrangement of that. And for me, it's kind of like a mantra for me, or sort of a touchstone every night when I go out there to kind of ground me. It gives me an opportunity to sort of express gratitude to Jonathan Larson, to the audience, to the people that knew me from when, you know, bought, you know, tickets for the front row and slept outside, to meeting my first husband. Like, I mean, it's just a time in my life that was, you know, was so, so deep for me. And also really speaks to trying to stay in the moment, you know, and stay present for things. And I think especially in our industry, it's just, you just can lose sight of that and lose perspective. And I think the greatest gift that Jonathan gave us was to be able to slow down and realize how fleeting life is and to really try to not take things for granted. And so, I'm not great at it all the time, but I try to incorporate that into my world as much as possible.
Well, thank you so much for being here. One thing that is a guarantee in our future is we will always have exciting Idina Menzel material, whether she's performing live or in some rad movie or in some rad show. So it's nice to catch you just in the middle of it before you springboard to your next 50 amazing things.
Oh, you're so sweet. I'm a fan of you both. And thank you for asking me all those are good questions you asked me.
Appreciate it. We don't always nail it.
It was an honor to have you.
All right, let's do this again.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You come back whenever you want.
Okay. I'll come back when I have my new musical that I'm working on. It's a brand new thing that's super in its nascent stages, but
We can't wait.
Come back and talk about it then.
Please.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, please do.
Well, that sounds
can't wait
news.
To see it.
All right.
Okay. Yeah.
Bye. Yeah.
Thanks,
Thank
Idina.
You so much.
Bye. A car is never just a car. Kelley Blue Book knows it's so much more than that. It's your commuting chariot, your road trip refuge, your I just need a reason to get out of the house. Your car is there for everything. And for everything car, there's Kelley Blue Book.
Need a new set of wheels? Price it on Kelley Blue Book. Problem under the hood? Fix it with Kelley Blue Book. Can another car do the job better? Trade it or sell it on Kelley Blue Book. We're here mile after mile, moment after moment. Price it, fix it, trade it, sell it. KBB.com. Visit KelleyBlueBook.com to get the journey started.
For over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night. No matter how chaotic your day is, conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.
Ashley's Memorial Day sale is going on now. Shop our biggest selection of hot buys, cool deals, or shop limited-time savings on new summer spaces. Plus, get 72-month special financing on select in-store mattress purchases made with your Ashley Advantage Synchrony credit card between May 14th and June 3rd. Whether you're redecorating indoors or rethinking your outdoor space, save big on this season's trending styles. Only at Ashley. Subject to credit approval. Minimum monthly payments required. No minimum purchase required. See store for details.
We have a special guest with us this episode. He is a writer and film critic whose book, The Queer Film Guide, chronicles the history of queer storytelling since the beginning of motion pictures. It's an incredible archive of history that we're so happy to shed a light on. Please welcome to Keep It, Kyle Turner. And I have a question. Why is salt not in your book?
Yeah, what? What gives?
Salt is not in the book because there's not enough latex.
There's really not. There's a lot of wigs, yeah, but there's no latex.
Yeah. Right. I have the Portuguese film O Fantasma, which has a gimp suit in it. So as if there was a gimp suit, then it would be in the book.
I have to say about the list of movies you compiled, this, first of all, it goes all the way back to 1918 and the famous German film, Different from the Others, the best title, all the way up to, looks like Fire Island here, which came out just last year. Are there titles in here, first of all, that you're surprised made it into it, or are surprised didn't make it into it, and how just impossible was it to compile all of these movies into one book? It just feels like an unbelievable task, and I don't envy any of the work you had to do.
I felt like a great deal of a gratitude for being able to have the opportunity to make a book like this and to compile a list. And I obviously am indebted to Vito Russo, who wrote The Celluloid Closet. It was originally like a lecture series that he sort of took on the road and then made into a book in two different editions. But then I also consulted friends who are really incredible archivists and programmers, like Juan Barquin, who's based in Miami, and Fung Le, who's based in London, and Elizabeth Purcell, who's an archivist, especially of like gay porn cinema. They all had like really interesting input. The original list was like 186 films, and I wanted it to be idiosyncratic enough so that like you can Google best queer movies and come up with 100 lists on the internet anytime. But if I was like trying to encourage people to have something in their home that they could refer to, I want it to be like a little weird and a little fun, so that you have things like Desert Hearts and Bound next to Jennifer's Body and Seed of Chucky, next to My Hustler and Scorpio Rising. And I wanted to really like examine how queerness could manifest as different things aesthetically or narratively or within character or within point of view. I guess the things that I was most surprised to that did end up in the book was I feel an incredible amount of gratitude that they let me put Boys in the Sand in there, which is the Wakefield Pool porn film that came out in 1971, I think. 1970.
Early
70s. That came out before Deep Throat. And it was one of the films to launch this idea of porno chic, and that porn cinema could be something that was like an event, that like it was the first porn film that was reviewed by Variety.
Wow.
Okay. Come on, Variety.
They're like, the box office, and this is going to be boffo, they scream.
actually, I have a question about, like, how you were even deciding to comprise of it. Because, like you said, like, you had, like, a larger list, and then, like, you cut it down. Like, in creating a queer film guide, was there ever a point where you're like, okay, here are some films that have maybe gay moments or elements in them that are maybe like, now we look back on them, they're like maybe like gay panic moments or like awful, you know, I'm thinking of like something like Soap Dish or something, like, for example, you know, were there moments where you were like, is that a film that you considered maybe even including, or films like that where you're like, it is sort of an awful moment like that represents queerness, but it is also representative of like the attitudes of people towards like trans people in 1991, you know?
I know exactly what you're talking about. And I think there are definitely examples of films that I think are important to queer cultural and queer cinematic history that are controversial or problematic or you have to wrestle with. Soap Dish is not one of them, because I even though like there are parts of that film that I do like, I don't think it is, I don't think it like contributes to queer film history in a productive way.
Of course, it's like a gotcha twist.
Yes, yeah. Whereas something like The Boys in the Band, the William Friedkin film that's based on the Mark Crawley play, is very much an artifact of its time. I know that some people like it. I like the play. But it like is very much enmeshed in a sort of like velvet, proto-Velvet Rage self-loathing. I don't know how to deal with the fact that I'm gay, and I'm beating myself up about it and sort of trying to buy into like bourgeois middle-class America isn't working for me because they didn't want me anyways. And I know that some people like don't care for confronting that aspect, even though I think it's very much a lived reality for a lot of people. And then there's something like Cruising, which is also directed by William Friedkin, which was protested upon its announcement and during its release, so much so that they had to re-record a lot of the dialogue. And so some of the disembodied voices within Cruising, it sort of adds to like the surreal effects. But like that film was coming out at a time where it does show the attitude that especially the police have towards queer people. The New York Anti-Violence Project was created within the year or so during its production to combat like real anti-queer violence within the city. But I think that film is interesting enough, and I think has enough good faith, or at least ambivalent faith, to examine like the structural issues of like where white queer people especially fall into positions of power, because it's about Al Pacino, who's playing a rookie cop, and he goes into the New York BDSM leather scene to investigate a series of savage murders. But during this time, like as he's going through these like leather clubs that really existed at the time, like the Ramrod and the Anvil and whatnot, he sees the way in which these social spaces are using the iconography of fascism, of Nazism, and fetishizing them. And while like you can't say writ large that all people who are into leather or into BDSM are also into fascism, it is undeniable that like the aesthetics of kink and leather are derived from very similar places as fascism and Nazism. That's just like, that's just the reality. And although like it's tricky to conflate those things with like the sort of rise of power within white gayness, I think it's like a really instructive object or artifact to consider like where how queer people interact with power and to what degree trying to attain that power is even worth it if it means like selling your soul and becoming a cop. It's like very ACAB movie.
I'm also super interested in how you chose the movies from like the past 10 years, because obviously we have way more movies to choose from nowadays. Whereas like, you know, if you're going back to the 1960s, you're picking like the, like a movie like Victim, which is very out of step with the time in terms of how like blatantly gay and kind of pro-gay it was. But Was it hard searching through the past 10 years of movies? I imagine it was just impossible to pare down.
It was a lot of fun paring down, and it was a matter of, like, do I want to pick the thing that is obvious and that has made, like, an enormous contribution to queer culture and the way that queer representation, whether in front of the camera or otherwise, is most easily seen? Or do I want to pick something that maybe people haven't heard of or don't necessarily think is queer? Something like Seed of Chucky, which I think was, like, relatively popular at the time, but I don't think a lot of people necessarily think, oh, that movie has, like, a non-binary / bi-gender person sort of as a main character.
Right.
That one was for me. And, okay. Seed of Chucky is that girl.
Yes, yes. Seed of Chucky. Just icon. Glenn or Glenda. And it was, and also, like, there, you have something like, the book also has 200 movies, technically, because you have 100 main entries, and then each film has a sidebar recommendation, a wine pairing, if you will. And so it allowed me to sort of, like, slip in things that if I were going to highlight something like Brokeback Mountain, mm-hmm. which I need to write about. Like, regardless of my own personal feelings about that film, it's fine. The Wedding Banquet is better. But it really did open the floodgates for queer representation and queer filmmaking in Hollywood, in mainstream filmmaking, in a way that very few films have. But it also means that I get to pick something like The Wedding Banquet, which comes in the early 90s. So I get to have both of those sort of complement each other. Because if you're not familiar with one, you get to, like, look at the other, see how it sort of sets up a blueprint for what queer movies can look like in the future. And then you have something like Professor Marston and the Wonder Women, which is by the same director of Debs. Both Professor Marston is a main entry and Debs is a sidebar entry, but I get to cheat a little bit and still pick a bunch of movies from the last couple of decades to show, like, the wide breadth that queer cinema can encompass, especially now that we have a slightly more democratized access to those filmmaking tools. We have a slightly more democratized access to these movies in general so that they can inspire other queer artists and filmmakers and creatives.
Mm-hmm.
We should say that the reason you bring up The Wedding Banquet is because Ang Lee also directed that.
And yes.
Just to say which some of the movies he chose from recent years, it's everything from Brokeback Mountain, as you said, to Carol, to Spa Night. Andrew Ahn also directed Fire Island, which is on this list. Zola, Can You Ever Forgive Me? Now, see, that's a movie where I would say, oh, that's like a mainstream movie that people have heard of. But honestly, do people remember that movie? That, to me, is part of the hard, but, like, what's hard about compiling a list like that is what feels obvious to mm-hmm. us is, like,
yeah,
like, people don't remember at all or whatever. Even though Melissa right, McCarthy was obviously right. nominated for an Oscar for it, and Richard E. Grant.
Yeah. And for those of whom that are in LA, I will be screening, I'm sorry for plugging in something, but I will be doing a double feature of Can You Ever Forgive Me and Happy Together, the Wong Kar-wai film, which is also in the book, at the American Cinematheque Los Feliz on September 1st at 7 p.m.
Oh, well, you have to go to that. I love both those movies. Fabulous.
Yeah. I want to ask, too, about, you know, I think you were talking about, you know, the democratization, too, of, like, you know, queer films now, and especially, like, now as you get into, like, the present, you know, there's a lot more queer films that we sort of can get, but also they're for different audiences. You know, obviously, you know, have, like, Fire Island, and, you know, you have, like, a Bros, and then, like, last week, Lewis and I talked about Red, White, and Royal Blue, and, like, Lewis also just, during the week, off of my recommendation, like, he watched Passages, which, you know, I love, you know, and sort of, like, where do you think we are right now in terms of queer cinema, and where it's going to be going in terms of adding things substantive to the canon?
That's an interesting question. And I think it is reflective of an even broader idea of, like, where we are in cinema and pop culture, generally speaking, because we don't really have zeitgeist anymore. We don't have a monoculture anymore. And even within these sort of subcultural communal spaces like the queer community, those things are being split up even more. And on the one hand, I think it is very good that we have more options for more audiences, for people to engage with different kinds of things. On the other, I do think that it is frustrating that a lot of the ways in which streaming platforms especially are inclined to make a certain product to cater to an audience that is that wants to consider queerness within a more limited idea. I do find that personally frustrating just on, you know, an aesthetic level. Like, yeah, red, white, and royal blue, totally fine. I, as much as I wanted to hate that movie, I was actually quite charmed by it. but what I hope is that with these platforms, that there will at some point be a prioritization of their being like a central hub for people to be able to look at these things. Like, I know that, like, when I was younger and getting into queer film, I had to actively search for these things, and I liked the process of looking for kinds of representation or kinds of reflections or different stories that didn't reflect my experience and could expose me to other kinds of experiences of queerness. And my worry is that these platforms are de-incentivizing that process and de-incentivizing a more holistic way of engaging with queerness as like a creative point of view or a political point of view. And I hope that at some point something comes along where all these different experiences are not only more readily available, which they appear to be, but will encourage their audiences to seek out other things beyond just red, white, and royal blue, or beyond just bros or something, that they are sort of willing to place themselves within like this broader lineage of queer cinema and creativity. But I'm glad I'm glad that there are these alternative venues and channels, like a movie that releases passages, or even a Strand releasing, which has a long history of releasing things by like Gregor Rocky and Andrew Ahn and whatnot. They just released Mutt, which is pretty solid. Yes, so I hope that answers your question. I have hope. I have hope that the kids. I actually just spoke to a group of students at Barnard recently, and the movies that they listed as their favorite were like really interesting, and I do have hope for the children. And Whitney Houston was right; the children may be our future. I'm on board. Some of them listed like "Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence," which is a Nakisa Oshima film with David Bowie. Someone mentioned M. Butterfly, the David Cronenberg film.
2.5-star movie for me, but good attempts. I enjoyed it.
Good attempt.
Jeremy can do whatever he wants. He messes up sometimes, but he was good at it. Yeah.
You're not a Cronenberg girl, though, Lewis.
No, as you know, I think something's wrong with that man. But
but something's so right with it. Wait, Lewis, how do you feel about Crash?
Oh, that's his best movie, I think.
Yeah. Mm. Uh-huh.
Do you like Videodrome?
Less so. Like, I like the idea of Videodrome. I was going to say, though, well, I think something, a problem with streaming platforms is, I mean, they're thinking in terms of demographics. And when they put, first of all, it would be conspicuous if they had no queer content. So they're going to have to produce some of it. But I think most of the time, those people produce queer content for women. It's like that's mm-hmm. the demographic that would actually consume that. So when you're watching something on streaming that's about gay people, you have to be thinking about like women who are 35 and up. I think that's who they're marketing it towards, you know, which is different than mm-hmm. queer content for queer people, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And the way in which these things are like hyper categorized and broken down into different genres and whatnot, I don't think that is necessarily conducive to exploring like the fluidity and the expansiveness that queer identity and queer experiences and queer cinema have to offer.
Yeah, I think we're all like, the same. You're
that's
wrong.
The point.
No, go ahead.
I feel like that's sort of a thing that I had brought up online once, you know, when people were discussing, you know, whether or not, you know, like whether you agree that like looking was like good or not, like a show like that, you know, like you think about like the success of RuPaul's Drag Race and like, you know, there's been a contingent online where it's just sort of like, well, this show isn't really for us anymore. And you're like it started as being for us, like with RuPaul sort of like doing his thing. But then, you know, like to be like a successful show, to be on this many seasons, like you have to have a female audience, the demographic watching it, you know? And I think about the way that so many women on TV historically, like Sex and the City, you know, or like Golden Girls, you know, it's like these things have been written by men. Ally McBeal, you know, they've been written by men for the consumption of women. And so it's just so interesting that like the queer stories that we see on television and, you know, like film and like especially on these streaming platforms now are going to be largely created, you know, for the consumption of a larger demographic, which includes women. You know, I always say that, like, Looking wasn't successful.
Yeah.
Right, Looking wasn't really successful because, you know, like, you look at that show and it's like, Andrew High is like, you know, he's making it very pretty to look at, you know, but, like, are women, like, are the masses, like, watching that show and being like, they want to talk about it every week, you know?
I had a conversation with a friend years and years ago in Provincetown, and we were talking about how there wasn't this sense of, you know, exciting danger to queer art and queer film, which is like very broad generalization, of course. We joked to each other that maybe it was a little better when we were a little bit more marginalized. Just a little bit.
Yeah, just like you were up against less, I guess. So you just like, yeah, you had nothing to lose sort of feeling.
Yeah. You could make something that was full of like fury and anger and anguish, like a living end or like a poison or whatever. Its function was to be provocative. And while I do believe that like there's still work out there being created in that vein, I don't know that I don't think it's getting necessarily the same attention. I do think that there is like somewhat of an acceptable, anesthetized and aestheticized version of like what queer movies are like really exciting for, you know, Oscar season and whatnot. They've got lens flare and kind of faux naturalism about them. But I am happy and excited for like whatever comes next, hopefully.
Well, you know, Maestro, that nose is LGBTQ. So,
yes.
Famously.
The Maestro nose was seen at Pieces.
Thank you so much for being here, Kyle.
Thank you so much for having me. I just want to say I've been a huge fan of your writing, Ira, since you were at MTV News.
Oh, thank you.
Showed my mother verbal voguing
when I was
like 12.
Jesus Christ.
And my mother did not understand it.
I was going to say, do you guys still have a relationship? Okay, great.
No, we do not. We do not.
Original recipe, Lewis. Wow, yes. How nice of you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It.
Oh, I'm here. I'm awake. Sorry. I'll participate. Hi. Me, Lewis Fertel. My Keep It this week goes to an article that I actually think I generally liked. Did it have to be this rude? I'm talking about this New York Times article, What Happens When a Pop Star Isn't That Popular? And there's a triptych on the article of Ava Max, Carly Rae Jepsen, and Kim Petras. And the subhead says, pop's middle class enjoys loyal online fan bases. For these artists, pop stardom isn't a commercial category, but a sound, an aesthetic, and an attitude. It's literally saying they're unpopular. What the fuck are they doing being alive?
Kill yourselves.
Yeah. From the New York Times. I mean... at the onset, I thought this was an article that didn't need to be written. Just it's, I mean, what kind of pitch is, what if some people weren't as popular as other people? Like, that's always been true since the beginning of time. Some people are superstars, some people aren't. But it basically gets into how these people now occupy a space that once belonged to the label indie. You know, people were obsessed with seeing them, particularly at live shows, etc. They have moments where they sort of peek through, scratch the surface of stardom, but ultimately
we get
they
it.
Just have these loyal fan bases.
The solo Debbie Gibson. She's no Madonna.
It's written by someone named Shad D'Souza. Basically, if you're a Carly Rae Jepsen fan, it feels like a slight to you and your identity. So I felt a little bit chosen and a little bit attacked. But at the same time, I think it makes a case that, you know, it's sort of random who gets to be a superstar and who sort of floats in this middle ground with people like Ava Max. And I did not realize it says Diamonds and Dance Floors, which is Ava Max's last album, spent 1 week on the album's chart. That is sort of surprising for someone who debuted with Sweet But Psycho, which was a top 10 hit.
Girl, that album went triple cardboard. And I still love her. But Diamonds and Dance Floors, like, the dance floor was evacuated.
Also, that album is so good. I just feel like it would have legs, you know?
Keeping Zirconia and foreclosure is what it really was. And I love her. But, like, when we talk about Ava Max, it's like nobody else. This is, like, the same thing I was saying with Padam Padam. It's like, I bring, like, Ava Max and, like, anybody else who is not, like, a gay who was up in the club, they're like, who?
No. Also, you know, Kylie Minogue was counting her lucky stars that she's not in this article.
You know what I did love? That they put my girl Charlie in there, but they were like, it was also sort of like, it felt like a teacher giving a report card, because it was very much like, Charlie XCX was, like, topping the hits with, like, you know, like, I Love It and, like, Boom Clap. And then, like, she was, you know, experimenting with pop and just sort of, like, not charting. But now she's back with, like, Speed Drive and, like, her other recent stuff. And it's like, when she tries, she can get a hit. And it's like, okay, girl, leave her alone.
A joy to have in class when she comes in and gets a C-. Yeah. Ira, what is your keep it this week?
You know what? My keep it is also to the New York Times.
Oh, take that, so, the gray lady.
Unfortunately, this article comes from a friend of ours.
Oh, which one?
David Mack. But I will say, okay, so, like, he wrote an article for the New York Times where it was just like, it was an analysis of, like, you know, like, it was breaking down, like, new information that, like, what gay men do when it's their birthday, they write, send nudes, and people send nudes to them. And I was like, one, stay out of gay people's business, New York Times. And two, it's not even really a keep it to the New York Times. I have always found that concept wild to me. I've never been a person who's, like, been like, it's my birthday, send nudes or something. I mean, like, are you that kind of person? I just, like, it feel like when I see someone do that, I'm always like, girl, go do something else.
Go to
a movie.
I just feel like it has extreme loser energy.
It does.
It's my birthday. Please, for once, consider me attractive. I mean, it just is not a vibe. Also, it's like, it's something like your friends are kind of supposed to do, like, send me nudes, like, we're friends. Like, it's like, ew.
Right.
It's just like, it's not sexual at all. It doesn't feel, nothing about that, it just creeps me out. I'm sorry.
It's also your birthday. So you, like, you want, like, Tiffany on Facebook from, like, ninth grade to send you her nudes, like, her tasteful boudoir photos? Is that what you want?
Yeah, no. It's the kind of thing also where I'm like, I guess you would write about it in the New York Times, because send nudes is, like, a familiar phrase now, so it has legs of some kind.
I mean,
but at the same time, it's a little weird. It's a little dubious. Yeah, it's a little late.
20 years too late.
Right.
They discovered Ishbal sooner than they discovered send nudes.
By the way, you say Ishbal all the time, and we want to say what that is. Ishbal is this, like, you put it under a caption, it means I just burst out laughing.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I really do bust out laughing. I mean, like, I laugh at a lot of your comments, too. Like, you know, like, I really do bust out laughing.
Journalistically, it's true, yes. One might say this about you.
The other thing I will say about, like, the send nudes thing is I'm like, yes, you're, like, announcing it for your birthday, but I'm like, if you're that girl, You're already getting them, okay? Uh-huh. Like, I got buffoons eating my pussy while I watch cartoons.
Is that a Megan paraphrase?
That's a Lil' Kim, baby.
Oh, because she Megan's.
That's like, hardcore 97.
Oh, right, right, right. Megan's is while I watch anime.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Megan watches anime.
You know my Lil favorite Kim Megan Thee Stallion lyric is? I don't stand outside because I'm too outstanding. That's my favorite one. Mm, that's my favorite Megan song, too. Girls in the Hood.
I love the idea of you listening to Girls in the Hood.
I love Megan Thee Stallion. I listen to her all the time. This has actually never come up on this show.
Oh, I don't think we've ever really talked about Megan. And I feel like, you know, like I'm like very Barbie, yeah. Like very Barb. But I feel like, I get that because I would say that like Megan Thee Stallion, I feel like, with one, like, I feel like she has, like, the best of, like, you know, like, a Nicki, like, Lil' Kim vibe of, like the raptress, but also, like, she has the performance element of, like, a pop star that you would like.
Totally.
And I feel like also her songs are very, because she has so many interests, like Girls in the Hood sounds very much like, it almost sounds like 90s, like, Queen Latifah, like Salt and Pepper, like-ish. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like she harkens back to, like, she's having fun.
Yes.
And that's what I want. I want the girls to have fun.
Witty, good vibes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, social. And, yeah.
And honestly, it's like,
I've gotten really into Trauma Zine. I think that underrated that when it came out.
That was like a really underrated album. And I feel like it has like a lot of really good songs on it. And I would also say that like, she and just like Cardi B in general are just like two really fucking likable female rappers. Like, they're so fucking funny, and they everything about them when you meet them seems very, it seems very genuine.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And it's not a put on as a celebrity. It's like we said before, it's like you put Cardi B on, like, the way that like you're like you're watching old like interviews of like, you know, celebrities from like the 80s or 90s on like talk shows, it's just like there's gonna be like some faggots like 20 30 years from now like watching old Cardi B interviews,
because totally.
Like, she's just effortless,
yes.
And Megan is too. And I'm actually like, first of all, you know that that Munchkin went to jail.
yes,
he's going
right.
to jail. Yeah, you know, Tory Lanez. But I feel like I'm really looking forward to this chapter being behind Megan's life, because I just feel like it's so like dark, and I'm looking forward to her like coming through with like that burst of energy and like, you know, joy that we really like in her.
Yeah,
you know?
She, and like, she did LA Pride this year, and she was a pure joy from start to finish. You know, she can, and also that was cool.
She's
that
so
she
amazing
did that.
Live.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
She's so fucking amazing live. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to like Megan's next chapter, like past all this shit.
Likewise,
so.
Likewise.
Yeah.
All right, I guess that's our episode this week, and I hope you loved Adina as much as we did. Man, I had a blast with her.
Girl, she was giving into us.
I thought so, yes.
Top guest.
Yeah,
top guest.
Totally. Yes, we got into it.
Adina Menzel, and also thank you to Kyle Turner for being here with us. And we'll see you next week. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. And our associate producer is Malcolm Whitfield. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III and Louis Vertel.
This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to our digital team, Megan Patzel and Rachel Gajewski, and to Matt DeGroot and David Tolles for production support every week.
And as always, Keep It is recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Welcome back to our studio, where we have a special guest with us today, Toucan Sam from Fruit Loops. Toucan Sam, welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here. Oh, and it's Fruit Loops, just so you know.
Fruit?
Fruit.
Yeah, fruit.
No, it's Fruit Loops. The same way you say studio.
That's not how we say it.
Fruit Loops, find the loopy side.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore One Nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic Raised Bed and Garden Soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.